Morning.
To ask you as we start our thoughts this morning by closing your eyes. Okay, right? And the reason why I want you to close your eyes is this. I'm pretty sure that every single one of us sitting here today has got a favorite verse or a favorite part of a hymn which deeply moves us. So I want you to just close your eyes. I want you to think about that verse, and I will read you my sort of favorite sort of lines from a hymn, actually. And you'll know the words very, very well, where the hymn goes, Lord, come then in thy kingdom, set up on earth thy throne, and lest thy sheep grow weary, come take them for thy own. Now, when the night seems darkest, come in thy glory bright. Come to redeem thine Israel and turn our faith to sight. And you can say, even just by reading it, I get a little bit emotional. And you have your own too. And newsflash, I asked Ian, and he has got a verse that makes him cry. Yes, Ian cries. Okay. Ian, the verses are these, actually. I checked with him on Wednesday. And the scripture was fulfilled, which saith, Abraham believed God, and it was imputed unto him for righteousness, and he was called the friend of God. That's the verse that deeply moves Brother Ian. And this morning, I want to talk about Joseph, because my father, who is sitting on the front row, is deeply moved by the story of Joseph, which I want us to think about. And it isn't the Andrew Lloyd Webber musical of Joseph. It's stripping back to a personality and a character which, the more you explore and interrogate, you find a deeply holy, committed man who did some pretty moving things and still has the ability to move us. And we are going to sort of end our thoughts today by looking at the verses which I think is the catalyst for us to be moved by him. So we're going to think about Joseph, okay? So let's open our Bibles, if you don't mind, at Genesis chapter 30, which is the beginning. So Genesis chapter 30 and verse 1. When Rachel saw that she bare Jacob no children, Rachel envied her sister and said unto Jacob, Give me children, or else I would die. Now, any man in the room who would have a partner who says that to, and you'd probably kind of think to yourself, Oh my goodness, what is the right thing that I say to my wife now? Because whatever I do say will be wrong. What does Jacob say to a wife who, I'm going to be quite with you, this is the masculine perspective, a little bit of a nutter. But obviously, it was a very, very tense time in Jacob's family life. Jacob, all he had to do was look at Leah, and she seemed to fall pregnant. You know, by this point here, she's already given Jacob five sons. So he was obviously a very, very proud man. And you can imagine the emotional escalation that was going on in the household. And you might even think of Elkanah and Hannah and Penina, where Penina sort of hassles Hannah about her inability to have children. And you can think about how much Rachel was sort of almost sort of out of her mind that her sister, who she knew was the less loved sister, was able to give Jacob the family that he obviously was desiring. And what is interesting as well was that Rachel doesn't really pull a really clever one here, if we're being honest with her, because what she then does, she brings the handmaids into the equation, doesn't she, in the opening verses of Genesis chapter 30. And she gives Jacob surrogate sons by Bilhah, and then obviously Zilpah gets involved as well. And so you've got surrogate sons, you've got six stepsons and no children. And then this is the atmosphere of the household that Joseph is born into. And you know, let's spin on to verses 22 to 24. God remembered Rachel and hearkened to her and opened her womb, and she conceived and bare a son and said, God hath taken away my reproach. And she called his name Joseph and said, the Lord shall add to me another. So some of you might think, well, that was Rachel being incredibly presumptuous, in the sense that here she was being blessed with the one son that they obviously really, really wanted. And she was assuming that God would give them another child, and sort of she could catch up with Leah somehow after all these years of being barren. And maybe I'm being a little bit unfair on Rachel. You know, we do know that Rachel is a little bit of a conundrum. We do know that she steals her father's gods when they leave Padan Aram in a few verses' time. But maybe we should give her the benefit of the doubt here, because in Genesis, the idea of God remembering is very, very powerful. By this chapter, we have already read about God remembering Noah in the ark, and God remembering Abraham when the time came for Isaac to come along. So maybe, you know, we can give Rachel the benefit of the doubt by the fact she was a woman of prayer, and she hearkened to Rachel's prayers to him and gave them the son. And Joseph comes along, and Jacob then decides that he is now time to leave and go back to Canaan. And one of the interesting thing is that, you know, you sort of see your Sunday school pictures and things like that, and Jacob is this young man, but no, he's a man of 90 years old at this point, because he was 70 when he actually left for Padan Aram in the first place. So Jacob is on his way home, and he, as we know, as we just turn our pages, let's just turn the pages in our Bible. So in chapter 31, they decide to leave, and Laban comes and overtakes them. In chapter 32, he then goes and meets up with Esau again. And chapter 34, we have the awful incident of Dinah. So interestingly, between chapters 33 and 34, we jump on probably about 15 or 16 years, because from the birth of Joseph, which was around the same time as the birth of Dinah, we are now very much into the frame of time when, you know, his family, or the youngest members of his family, were teenagers. And so we come across in Genesis 37, in the first few verses, the very, very famous bit of Joseph's life. And we'll start in verse 1. Jacob dwelt in the land where his father was a stranger, in the land of Canaan. And these are the generations of Jacob. Joseph, being 17 years old, was feeding the flock with his brethren. And the lad was with the sons of Bilhah and with the sons of Zilpah, his step brothers, as it were, his father's wives. And Joseph brought unto his father evil report. Now Israel loved Joseph more than all his children, because he was the son of his old age, and he made him a coat of many colors. So Jacob is probably about 107 now, 17 years on. And Joseph, his son, is dreaming dreams. And he tells tales. And again, we kind of think to ourselves, well, you know, is Joseph sort of showing his maturity by standing up and proclaiming these dreams to his brothers and his father and to his mother? Okay, somebody who perhaps wasn't reading the room right on this one. Okay, let's face it, the years of hatred were starting to build and accelerate now. And here was Joseph snitching on his brothers for whatever bad report they had done. And then he decides to really hit them all hard with the dreams, which we know talk about the preeminence of Joseph. And there was going to be a day in the future where these brothers, older and nastier than Joseph, were going to bow down to them. And I just wonder whether, you know, Jacob is a little bit at fault here, okay? You know, I have the blessing of only having one child to bestow my love on it. Jeff has two. I don't know how you get on with it, Jeff, with between Thomas and Joshua. Okay, but
But Jacob had 12 sons now to choose from, okay? And he lavishes the love on Joseph very, very openly. I think the record is clear that Jacob is making a bad mistake by doing this. Maybe as well, he was starting to realize that the sons of Leah weren't particularly nice people, actually, given what we know about Reuben and Simeon and Levi and the other brothers up to this point. If you want a bit of a laugh, okay, there is a Joseph in my household where my younger brother was the beloved son, to be honest with you. So you can go and ask David about that later, okay? And he was the son of his old age as well, but you can talk to Joe the next time he's here. But the idea of dreaming here is quite interesting. The root word, actually, if you get your Strong's Concordance out, it has this idea of firmly binding. So yes, it does mean dreaming, but there's a firmness about this. Okay, so Joseph, I think here was he was being a prophet. He was not just being the family priest when he's given the coat of many colors. Not only was he being the preferred son because Reuben had made a bit of a mess of it as the eldest son, he was being a prophet as well. And we know what Jeremiah said when he had to stop talking, okay? Remember the words that he said that, it was like a fire inside of me that I had to speak. So perhaps that's the situation that we find ourselves here in Genesis 37, that Joseph, despite the slight naivety that I think we think about this, he feels as though he has to tell his brothers and his family about this prophecy that one day he was going to be bowed down to. And I think that's something that I've landed on as I've looked at this morning here. Joseph was acting, young though he was, as a prophet, as a priest, as somebody who was to mediate on behalf of his family. Joseph was, as it were, the suffering servant. Let me just read to you from a few chapters' time, actually, when Reuben recalls it, actually. So they sit, and this you don't need to follow this through, but they said one to another, "We are very guilty concerning our brother in that we saw the anguish of his soul, and he besought us, and he would not hear, and we would not hear. Therefore, this distress has come upon us." So I want us to think just for a few moments what Joseph actually says. Okay, so we've just had the dreams. Okay, the rest of it is quite interesting narrative where we don't really learn much about what Joseph says. The next time Joseph speaks is actually in Genesis 39. So if you just turn over to Genesis 39, if you don't mind. So Joseph has remained silent. We don't really hear his words until we've heard the dreams, and then we spin on to chapter 39, and where does Joseph's words come out? Well, it's actually in verse 8 and 9 when he is talking to Mrs. Potiphar. And he says, he refused, verse 8, and said unto his master's wife, "Behold, my master wotteth not what is in me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hands. There is none greater in his house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God?" And I get the sense that here he is talking from his heart, isn't he, brothers and sisters? He's talking about the responsibility that he has and the wrongdoing, and it is not the wrongdoing of him. Joshua, how old are you now? 15, okay, right? So that Joseph's 2 years older than you on this one, okay, right? And he's in the prime of his life, isn't he, really? I'm sure he was an attractive lad. It says that he was goodly to look upon, wasn't he, really? But Joseph is different, isn't he, in his perspective, because it's not about him having a good time in the house of Potiphar. It's about him showing the ways of God. And he doesn't say, "I'm sorry, Mrs. Potiphar, I'm not going to do this." It's that, no, I would be sinning against God. And that is the words of somebody who's not a great deal older than Caris or Joshua. That is the context of how deep and how holy Joseph was as a personality. And I think it's very, very insightful that here was a man who thought about God first, despite all of his sort of advantages, being this sort of high up in the house and being a good-looking lad and things like that. He shows his colours very, very clearly that he was a man of God. And we know that he leads to suffering because of that, doesn't he? And he gets thrown into the prison, doesn't he? And the interesting thing is that we don't really know how long he was in prison for, do we? You know, the next time, as we read this morning, we know his age. He's 30 years old. So was Joseph in the household of Potiphar for 1 year before this happened? So he was in prison for 12 years. Did it happen 5 years down the line? I think we have to take the lesson, and I sort of say this to Karis and Joshua maybe. Joseph lost the prime years of his life to prison and to horrible circumstances that none of us really would ever wish in any part of our lives. And by the time he sort of comes through it and is blessed by Pharaoh, as we read this morning, he's past his prime, in the context of the ancient world. And we need to think that here he was sort of articulating his life around this and that his demeanor. And so maybe this is an exhortation for us, is about being like Joseph, but also recognizing that by the time we get to Genesis chapter 41, we see that we need to be patient with God. Patience is something I don't really possess that much of, but God has taken a long time to bless Joseph. And we read about it this morning, didn't we, really? So let's just turn over to verses 15 and 16, where Joseph again, this is the words of Joseph coming out in verse 16. Joseph answered Pharaoh and said, "It is not for me. God shall give Pharaoh an answer of peace." And he's already said that to the butler and baker in the previous chapter, okay? When he's in the prison with the butler and the baker and he hears the dreams about the grapes and the bread, he doesn't say, "Well, I'm a clever guy. Let me tell you what I think, which will happen to you." He says, "No, all interpretations are from God." He says the same thing to Pharaoh. And I just wonder whether that's an example for us in our lives today, okay? How quickly do we give our circumstances the credit to God in that time, okay? Or do we kind of take it for ourselves and our own pride and things like that? Or we just say, "No, you know, this is what God has given me in my life today." Because that's what Joseph is saying to Pharaoh, isn't it now? He's saying, "I am here, but let me tell you, the interpretation is from God, the God that I serve." And so what we are reading here is not this sort of big-headed personality here that you sometimes comes through Andrew Lloyd Webber's musical. We're reading about a deeply holy person who put God first and told people God about God first and suffered for his convictions throughout the best part of his life. So let's just turn on and into the next chapters. Let's move on to chapter 42, where it's now practically 9 years later, where his brethren actually come and buy corn. And actually, it's interesting. This is where Joseph's words actually start to become more prevalent, actually, in this part of the story. Joseph remembered the dreams which he dreamed them and said to them, "Ye are spies to see the nakedness of the land you have come." And then we know what happens, don't we? That they go through this period of testing. And I want us to think about this. This is now 21 years later since Joseph was taken into Egypt at the hands of his brothers. And that's the context of Abraham, isn't it, really? Abraham had to wait 25 years for God's blessings and God's sort of will and plan to be out worked. And here is Joseph having to live through a very, very similar time frame for to see this dream come true. So this is where we really do come to the $64,000. This should be moving us here, because when we come to Genesis chapter 45, where things are starting to come to that wonderful finish that we know, we read these words. He realizes that his brothers indeed change people. He realizes that the years have been good to his brothers in the sense that they have seen the error of their ways, and he's sort of welled up with emotion. And we read in verses 4 to 8 these words: Joseph said unto his brethren, come near to me, I pray you. And they came near and said, I am Joseph, your brother, whom you sold into Egypt. Now therefore be not grieved, nor angry with yourselves that you sold me hither, for God did send me before you to preserve life. Verse 7, and God sent me before you to preserve you as a posterity in the earth, and to save your lives for this for a great salvation. So it was not you that sent me hither, but God. And you think about exactly what the power of those words mean, doesn't it, really? Here was a man who was 39 years old, who had spent probably somewhere like 13 years in prison, that he had suffered injustice at the hand of his family, that he had been in a foreign land for most of his life now, and he was able to contextualize his sufferings to enable his brothers, the brothers that didn't even particularly like him, to have life and to have this outworking of the promises to Abraham. Perhaps Joseph knew that this was the starting point, that the 12 tribes were now in place, that the promises to Abraham, where he would indeed be a great nation, Joseph knew that he was one of the mechanisms that that would be. And so he understood that his God had put him through those challenges so that they, should I say, would actually live and have life and lead the promises to God and to the world through to its next chapter. And I think it is deeply, deeply moving. Going back to what I said right at the beginning, and I haven't actually asked my dad this, but I suspect these are the words that should be moving us to tears. Because here is a man who, from a young age, understood what it was to be a follower of God. And sometimes there would be a lot of rough before there'd be a lot of smooth. And maybe that's how we need to contextualize our lives as we think about some of the trials that we go through today. We don't always have the great time that God asks of us. Sometimes there are low points as well. And yet, Joseph here is a man who helps us walk through that sort of emotional journey to see that indeed God is always there. It says back in Genesis 37 that God was with Joseph in prison. God was with Joseph as he was promoted with the prison guard, that God was with Joseph when he was in Potiphar's household. God is always there, no matter what time of life that you think you are in at this point. But he sent Joseph to send them for a great deliverance and to save their names in the earth. And that really is the reason why I wanted to talk about this subject this morning. Because just as moving as Joseph's words were, this is how we need to contextualize our life with the bread and the wine and the life of the Lord Jesus Christ. Who has believed our report? And to whom is the arm of the Lord revealed? He shall grow up before him as a tender plant, as a root out of dry ground. He hath no form or comeliness. And when we see him, there is no beauty that we should desire him. He is despised and rejected of men, a man of sorrows and acquainted with grief. And we hid, as it were, our faces from him. He was despised, and we esteemed him not. Surely he hath borne our griefs and carried our sorrows, yet we did esteem him stricken, smitten of God, and afflicted. But he was wounded for our transgressions, he was bruised for our iniquities. The chastisement of our peace was upon him, and with his stripes we are healed. All we like sheep have gone astray. We have turned every man to his own way, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all.